Well, I want to thank everybody for being here today. As you can see from the title of the presentation, basically I'm going to be talking about three things. One is this idea of populism as it exists in American politics today. Also, I'm going to be talking about how that relates to the rise of various left and right-wing protests. And how does this all tie into this last election? What do those things tell us moving forward? I'm working on a project right now. It probably won't be out for another year in terms of a book, but it's on modern protest and the relevance of left and right-wing protest. And basically the main argument of this project is that to the extent that poor people and disadvantaged individuals and repressed groups get represented by the political process and by the political system, it really is primarily dependent on the strength and the vigor and the action of social movements. Now, this is not like an equal thing across the board, since that people might say, well, conservatives engage in social movements, so do progressives and leftists, and it's all about democracy because people are all participating and trying to be represented. I don't make that argument here. I think, I'm talking specifically at disadvantaged groups of Americans. If you look at what are referred to as right-wing protest movements or insurgencies or populism today, and that includes Tea Party through Trump. We're really talking about the reinforcement of various types of privilege. So what I'm arguing is the opposite of that. I'm arguing that that social movements, rather than political institutions or political parties, are the primary means through which disadvantaged people get represented, to the extent that they get represented at all by political systems and by the political process. It happens through that. So in order to really get into this point, first, I'm going to cover three things. First, it'll be the populism stuff, and then I'll get into some of these actual social movements and what was driving them. And then we'll talk a little bit about the 2018 election and what that means. So, in terms of the populism, this is a term that gets thrown around quite a bit. I'm not sure how many people have thought really carefully about what the actual definition is. Fortunately, there's been a lot of scholarship that actually looks at what populism is and tries to define it. So, when I say populism, I want to be perfectly clear about what I'm talking about here. It's been referred to by intellectuals and scholars as a quote-unquote thin ideology, which means that it can be stretched to include left-wing, progressive, democratic sort of ideas, and also right-wing movements as well. So it doesn't have an exact definition in terms of ideology, but it has to do with this idea of more, there's certain number of characteristics that have to do with defining it. One of those things is the idea of being anti-elitist. And that kind of rhetoric shows up on the American left and on the American right. What you'll notice with this definition is that a lot of these things, you can apply them very easily to the rise of Trump. You could apply it to the rise of a Bernie Sanders style candidate or a Donald Trump candidate. They're that general. The term can fit both or be taken to fitting both. So this idea of anti-elitism, meaning that you're against the, quote, establishment. What does that mean? It can mean a lot of things depending on who you're talking about. This idea of an us versus them mentality that fits into that anti-establishment thinking. And when I say us versus them, the idea of the us meaning that there's some sort of general and strong faith in the superior thinking and wisdom of the average man, or average person, we could say. That's a very common part of this populistic language and rhetoric, that we need these very emotional appeals to the alleged wisdom of the masses. There's a sort of romanticization going on of ordinary people, which I argue it may or may not be warranted, depending specifically on what politics you're pushing, right? This nationalistic angle has always been a big part of populism as people have studied it and understood it. So you can have nationalistic appeals from a sort of leftist or right-wing approach, and that happens across many nations. It's definitely happening in the United States now if you look at this idea of Trumpian populism and extreme sort of nationalism. Also, the idea of a strong national leader and a very sort of personalistic connection that gets created, or a perception of a personalistic connection with the leader, which can be quite dangerous if we're looking at populist leaders who sort of consolidate power over time and take on more and more power. There's this idea and this question of creeping fascism in the United States that's getting a lot of play among intellectuals now. The idea that maybe fascist principles become more and more fashionable over time and more powerful and resonant. And obviously, you know, this is a threat if you're talking about a populistic leader who is sort of, you know, the focal point of that creeping fascism. We're talking about Donald Trump here. Let's clear the air. You know, people have been talking about the idea of creeping fascism with regards to his administration and the rise of the alt-right, white nationalists, and so on. Theatricality. Theatricality is also a big part of the modern understanding of populism. Scholars have really pushed that idea quite a bit. I don't think I have to push this idea that much if we're talking about Donald Trump. He clearly has his own rhetorical flair and flamboyance and theatricality. Go to Twitter any given day and you're going to see plenty of that and then the media response to it. So these things all come together in most standard sort of definitions of populism. I think the part about faith in the people is really important to focus on because it could be a very well-placed faith or a very misplaced faith depending on what politics are being used to mobilize these people. It's a double-edged sword, in other words. So if you're talking about pushes for progressive democratic change, as I'm going to argue, with regard to various social movements in modern times, they could have a very positive impact. If you're talking about sort of right-wing reactionary populism, which is oftentimes, as I've found, very top-down and doesn't have a very strong bottom-up social movement grassroots component, it's still mobilizing people in a passive way. It can have very negative consequences, as we've seen, in terms of policies proposed by political leaders and implemented that really discriminate against people and create different tiers in society or reinforce those tiers of inequality. So I don't want to come off as an elitist because I'm not. I argue in the book, you know, the main argument is that progressive social movements are the key to democratic change and to representing disadvantaged groups. So in that sense, there's a very much a sort of Gramscian approach here. And by when I say Antonio Gramsci, the famous Italian Marxist. He talked about this idea of the organic intellectuals, to the extent that you have real democratic change or even revolution, it has to come from below, and it's not going to come from, not primarily at least, from elitist intellectuals. I guess you could put me in that category. I sort of straddle the line between elitist intellectuals and being part of these social movements. So I try to do both, but you know, you'd have different, conceptually different types of intellectuals. So the idea of the organic intellectual, someone who's sort of a bottom-up, it could be a labor organizer or some other type of activist, community organizer. You know, those things are absolutely essential. So I don't want to downplay any of that. I think it's all extremely important. But it really depends if you talk about, you know, populism, again, how people are being mobilized. So if you have a problem of mass ignorance and you have support for candidates that's based on fear and bigotry and misogyny, and then those things are mobilized in a large scale, behind a political leader, you could call it whatever you want to call it. You can call it populism. You could call it a movement of some kind, but it's not going to be a democratic one. So that's an important point. So what I'm talking about in my research, in terms of right-wing populism, particularly the Tea Party and the rise of Donald Trump, the idea of Trumpian populism. On the left, going back within the last 10 years or so, the rise of labor protests, particularly in Madison, Wisconsin in 2011, then Occupy Wall Street. I talk about the Fight for 15, living wage movement. Talk about how these things culminated in the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016 and what that has meant beyond 2016 in terms of Democratic politics. I'm also talking about the anti-Trump protests that followed his election. And within that, I would probably include the Me Too movement because a lot of that was, in a significant way, a response to Donald Trump and the rise of his unique form of populism and misogyny. So I'm looking at all of these different movements, and one of the key points that I make over and over, and I really try to contrast what I'm saying with the dominant sort of academic and journalistic narrative, there's this narrative out there that says that people get really angry. They get angry at the status quo politically and economically, and there are a lot of people out there who are economically insecure. Maybe it has to do with rising poverty and inequality, maybe outsourcing of jobs with manufacturing, whatever it is, you know, downward economic turns, recessions and economic crashes, whatever is causing economic anxiety or frustrations, and then people become really angry and then they go vote for right-wing reactionary political leaders. So this has been the pretty dominant narrative in American journalism for years now. And amongst a lot of academics, they've accepted this too. There's really no evidence of this whatsoever. If you look really closely at the actual surveys that are being done of various social movements, and when Americans are asked about these movements, You find over and over that there's a almost complete lack of a connection between all different types of statistical measures of economic insecurity and frustration that are actually tied to people's real finances and support for whether it's the Tea Party or Donald Trump. So that's part of what I'm doing as sort of a setup to my book project and my research is looking at, for example, the Tea Party. If you look really closely at the Tea Party in 2009 to 2010 to 2011, people were asked in surveys about things like whether they had a job, whether they were unemployed, what kind of income they were making, whether they were suffering from different kinds of economic anxiety. None of these things were statistically linked to being more likely to support the Tea Party. And this was across many different types of financial worries that people expressed when they were asked in surveys, whether it was about concerns about their finances and the ability to afford housing, or rising economic prices beyond whatever cost of living adjustment they were getting, the ability to make ends meet financially, their job situation and their concern with jobs in general and in the country, concerns with things like free trade and whether that had actually hurt your finances or not, the general rating of your personal finances and how happy or unhappy you were with those, whether the recession in 2008 onward had affected your finances. A lot of these measures are out there. They're just sitting there. None of those things had anything to do with the Tea Party, and they virtually had nothing to do with rising Trump support either. What you did find in the case of the Tea Party was that you had a lot of economic attitudes were associated with Tea Party support, but they were of the exact opposite kind you think you would see among people who are economically frustrated or people who are worried about rising poverty or inequality and so on. So when people were asked, do you think that the United States is making progress on reducing inequality? People who said yes, delusionally, to that point, because we've had rising inequality for 40 to 50 years now. It's been like clockwork. People who said, oh yeah, we're making progress on that, they were more likely to support the Tea Party. They were completely out of touch with this issue of inequality. Are we making progress on creating all types of well-paying, middle-class style jobs? People who thought that that was happening were more likely to support the Tea Party. There was this general sense that there were people who might have been unhappy with the economy, saying it was only in fair or poor shape, that were more likely to support the Tea Party, but it was really not connected in any substantive way to their actual finances. So there was this vague sort of malaise under the Obama years in 2009 to 2010. We had a lot of Tea Partiers who were angry about his health care reform bill, really, and they wanted smaller government, they wanted less taxes. They had this vague sense that the economy wasn't doing well, but it really wasn't tied to any sort of progressive beliefs. If anything, they were quite reactionary in a lot of their political and economic beliefs. They wanted government to spend less to help needy people, tax rich people less, and so on and so on. This was what really defined the Tea Party. And it was an extremely anemic movement, to the extent that it was a movement at all. I use that term in my work, anemic populism, which means extremely thin from the bottom up. One thing that was very clear from looking at some of these surveys is that if you looked at people's opinions about things like the Affordable Care Act and about size of government, support for the Tea Party itself was much weaker than people's general attachments to being a Republican and being attached to the Republican Party. It's actually a really important point to bring up, because standard sort of partisan affiliations with the Republican Party were what were really driving some of these big attitudes that were supposedly attached to the Tea Party. So the Tea Party was really sort of a second-tier predictor of conservative beliefs. And actually, that's not the case when you look at progressive social movements. When you look at these movements that I'm going to talk about, whether it's Fight for 15, the Madison protests, Occupy Wall Street, also Black Lives Matter, I'm going to talk about a little bit too. Attachment to these movements is a much better predictor of people's support for all different types of progressive policy reforms than, let's say, being a Democrat. That's an important point. That's a big distinction between right and left in the United States. You have these movements that are alleged movements. They're pretty thin. They're pretty weak in terms of how much they appeal to Americans compared to more traditional partisan forces. This happens on the right, not so much on the left. It's really these progressive movements that have to push people toward embracing progressive policies. That shouldn't be a surprise to anyone familiar with the modern state of the Democratic Party, that they're not doing a very good job of being a strong progressive party. That's being generous. I'm trying to be diplomatic. So Yeah, I think this is important. You know, when we get to the Trump administration, the rise of Trump, this is really a continuation of the things I've been talking about. This idea of the anemic populism. There's not even like a pretense anymore of a social movement. People talk about, and I've heard this term used by journalists and academics sometimes, modern sort of Trump populism, and people sometimes throw on this word movement. I think you have to be sort of high to accept this characterization. Because what movement? What are we talking about? I mean, doesn't a movement, it has to have like, you know, this idea of an organic, bottom-up, people coming together within a community, grassroots, protesting. You've got people who go to rallies. People who go to rallies centered on a candidate, this idea of a cult of personality, really. And then they vote. That's not a movement in any recognizable sense in the way that any sort of people who study social movements would recognize. So these terms have been sort of watered down and diluted over the years. The Trumpian populism thing was almost entirely top-down. The very fact that you have to call it Trumpian populism should tell you everything you need to know about it in terms of bottom-up versus top-down. The big difference between the Tea Party and Trump, they're both cases of anemic populism in terms of people being mobilized from the top down, but there was one big shift. The Donald Trump-style populism was much more motivated by social issues than economic ones. So if you're talking about the Tea Party, you're talking about reactionary economic positions. If you're talking about Trump, you're talking about primarily social positions that were reactionary. And what I mean by that is if you look at some of these surveys, the best predictors statistically of support for Trump, survey after survey, year after year, question after question, not a small sample here. Things like being opposed to Muslims, being suspicious of Muslim immigrants, linking that to concern with terrorism, concern with gun rights and protecting gun rights, being anti-immigration in general, framing immigration in general as harmful to the nation and its people and its resources and its identity, being pro-life, so a position on abortion, being against refugees immigrating to the United States, particularly Syrian refugees. Maybe most importantly and really interestingly, the best predictors of support for Trump were not only ideology in the sense of being a conservative, but being a Republican. That might not sound very sexy or flashy if I say, well, being a Republican was the strongest predictor of supporting Trump, but that actually sort of matters, because when you have all these people saying that you know, the Trump uprising was about resisting the status quo. This was the status quo being repeated and reinforced. This was nothing new whatsoever. This was traditional right-wing conservatives, people who were disproportionately more likely to be white, a lot of white women and white men, but middle income to middle higher income. This is really nothing sort of as a huge deviation from the typical turnout and demographic groups that come out in support of the Republican Party. So that's actually a really important point. Despite how obvious it might sound to people, there's been a tremendous amount of resources and energy devoted in media and among intellectuals to obscuring sort of these basic points, to making this seem like it's something more than it is. To the extent that you had any sort of predictors of Trump support that had to do with economics, they were again reactionary, although they were secondary to the social issues. So people who actually opposed raising the minimum wage were more likely to support Trump. They wanted people who wanted to lower taxes on people making more than $250,000 or making more than $250,000 a year. People who said that they wanted government to actively go out of its way to not help people who are poor and needy. That was a significant predictor of Trump support. So we need to get this idea, and I'm saying more generally, you know, I think a lot of people on the left have done a good job of sort of crying foul on some of this propaganda, but in general as a society, we've done a really bad job of understanding sort of where this right-wing populism came from. Interestingly enough, one of the best predictors of Trump support was three things coming together: people who were white, people who were racist, and when I say racist, I mean in surveys, they would say things like, too much diversity in the United States is a really bad thing and hurts our identity and culture and people. And having to do with like immigration and just racial diversity in general. racial and ethnic diversity. So white people who were basically xenophobic and racist and really, really, really concerned about their guns. These three factors, when coming together, interacted in a way where this was like maybe the best predictor of support for Trump. Now, it's not hard to sort of think about how these things would be interacting together in terms of impacting people's beliefs. You've got a group of Americans who are overwhelmingly white. We're saying that the others are coming to get us, whether it be immigrants or Muslims or people of color, whether it be black people within cities who are disproportionately depicted as criminals or drug dealers or whatever, and we need our guns to protect ourselves from these alien criminal minority hordes. I mean, this really was sort of the center of what this campaign was about. In the rhetoric and in terms of how it appealed to the average American, that was the best predictor of anything you could find. It had nothing to do with class. If you looked at people and you asked them to identify as a class, whether it was lower or lower middle or middle or whatever, all different class identities, that was not in any way a predictor of Trump support. Class and race had nothing to do with it. People who said that they were white in surveys and maybe lower class, that really wasn't statistically related to Trump support either. Even though there was a big narrative about that. Oh, the white working class is coming to vote for Donald Trump and they're going to, you know, change the status quo of American politics and there's this uprising and so on. Not really. Not in surveys. We didn't see that. There was a moderate relationship between being white and saying you're a factory worker and supporting Trump. But if you took a close look at those people, being a factory worker could suggest a lot of different types of finances for individuals. So there really wasn't any evidence that white factory workers, although being a little bit more likely to support Trump, that they were making less than the average income that other people were making. That really wasn't borne out in any of the data. Income wasn't a significant predictor of Trump support. Being unemployed or employed wasn't. The point that Robert Hughes just brought up is that, you know, how much this was like petty bourgeois people, sort of middle income to maybe middle higher income, that really was the dominant sort of profile in both of these cases. The vast majority of people who are lower class or lower income were not voting for Donald Trump. Or in the case of the Tea Party, too, they were really sort of middle to middle higher income. So not extremely elitist, but sort of solidly situated economically to generally more well off. I guess the term that you would use was relatively affluent. That would probably be a good way of describing it. So we know what these things are. I think that the real lesson here, for me at least, is just how badly a lot of intellectuals and academics and journalists have just sort of flipped this. If you look closely at these progressive movements, they were the ones that were reflecting the interests of people who were disadvantaged, whether you measured that by income or by skin color generally. We see when we look closely at these different protest movements, we could start with Madison, for example. The Madison protests in 2011, which are seemingly becoming more relevant again now with the defeat of Governor Scott Walker. It's coming sort of full circle in the last election race. What was really behind support for the Madison protest and unions in general, if you looked at surveys, poorer whites, poorer African Americans, poorer people of Latinx descent, particularly Latina, meaning Latin American women. These three groups were significantly more likely to say that they supported unions and thought that they were really necessary for protecting average people and making sure that they get treated well. Now, this is something that if you're talking about sort of the dominant hegemonic discourse, neoliberal discourse today, is not getting a lot of play in a lot of these discussions because of the implications. The implications being that these progressive movements are the real people. The people behind them are the real people representing the average American, or at least disadvantaged groups. If you look at Occupy Wall Street, one of the big predictors with regards to support for Occupy Wall Street was not so much poorer whites, but poorer white men. That was probably, economically speaking, that was the big group that they appealed to. So one of the issues that came up with Occupy Wall Street was that it did a really good job of appealing to one specific group of disadvantaged Americans, white men who felt after 2008 that the economy was not providing basic opportunities for them, people who had become radicalized, maybe in favor of even socialistic ideas. that's sort of another thing to get into. What does that even mean these days when words like socialism are thrown around quite a bit? Whatever it means, Occupy Wall Street supporters said they liked it. At least when you look at surveys, that was one of the big sort of undergirding principles driving support. One big problem, if you talk about some of these movements, particularly Occupy Wall Street, is that they just really did not do a very good job of speaking to other groups outside of disadvantaged whites and poorer white men. I mean, there's a lot of issues out there, right? If we're talking about disadvantaged groups, we could be talking about women who are discriminated against in the workforce due to misogyny and sexism, sexual assault, sexual harassment. We could be talking about people of color, African American, Hispanic, who are discriminated against, things like racial profiling, police brutality. There are a lot of different ways that repression is experienced by disadvantaged groups. Occupy did not do a very good job of speaking to a lot of those outside of white males who were economically insecure. If you actually look at some of the accounts of what was going on in some of these protest encampments like Zuccotti Park, it was very visible on the ground as well. You had largely white male activists who were doing a really good job of sort of dominating the discourse in these meetings and protests. But the protest really didn't do a good job with these other groups. And not only did they do a bad job, if you looked at certain groups, poorer black men and women, poorer Hispanic men and women, they were actually actively more likely to oppose Occupy. So not only did they not cultivate support from these groups were actively critical of them. So you have these different protest movements on the left. Each one is sort of unique historically when you look at what it's speaking to. And what I'm going to try to get at here is a broader point that if you can sort of combine a lot of the individual issues that each one of these movements is speaking to and bring them into a broader coalition, then you might actually have some sort of prospect for real progressive sustained change in the United States. We haven't really gotten to that point yet. The Fight for 15 living wage movement. One thing that they did really well, that movement, although it has only seen inconsistent success at best, if you're talking about various municipalities and states that actually have raised the minimum wage, is that it has done a good job of appealing to disadvantaged groups of Americans. So if you look at not just income in surveys, but if you look at poor whites, poor people of color across the board, they do really like this idea of a $15 an hour minimum wage. It is something that really does unite different groups of people. Interestingly enough, and I don't want to sound like a Sanders booster because I think there were a lot of problems with his campaign, but also he is the most progressive sort of mainstream candidate we've seen in recent decades. I think the real legacy of these three movements I've been talking about, whether it be Madison, Occupy, or the Fight for 15, is that those three came together in his campaign. He made it very clear when he was running for president during the Democratic primary in 2016, that he was actively drawing on these movements as inspiration. So when you talk about the people who voted for Bernie Sanders, you are talking about people who were voting for a candidate who drew directly on these movements. That's important because it suggests, and this is not a lesson that is really any different from any of the previous social movements if people have studied progressive ones, that at some point you get what's called co-optation. Gramsci was big on this idea of co-optation, that social movements and protests might eventually, elements of them get taken over by one of the major political parties, and I think that was clearly happening here. Now, it hasn't fully happened. The Democratic Party is seemingly pretty split today. You've got a neoliberal, imperialistic, status quo-oriented group, which is still the dominant group, I would say. You also have this sort of insurgent, populistic, left-leaning, Sanderist group. And increasingly, quite a few political leaders who are reflecting that position who are getting elected across the country. So I'm not here to, I would say, be a booster for the Democratic Party today, but these things are happening. So they are worth sort of recognizing and talking about. To the extent that I talk about Black Lives Matter in the book and Me Too, I also point out that these are liberal, left, progressive movements that, you know, one thing if you look at Black Lives Matter is that it really brought together not just people of color, but poor people of color, who in surveys were much more likely to support it. And Me Too at its core is fundamentally about women in the workplace who feel financially insecure and are worried about coming forward in the face of misogyny and sexual discrimination and harassment. So all of these movements have something in common in the sense that they're speaking to poorer and disadvantaged or financially insecure groups in one way or another. I think the real challenge moving forward is building institutions, whether it be a party-based institution, because we're not there at this point, or community-based organizations, or rebuilding American labor, American labor unions, finding a way to get these groups, which have to this point been somewhat disparate, and you know, these somewhat separated movements. They've got different foci, really. They've got different focus for each one of these movements. Finding a way to take all of this and bring it together into an actual coalition. The big problem that came up with the Sanders campaign is that he did a very bad job of appealing to people across gender, class, and color lines. Did a very good job, if you look at surveys, of getting support from people who had lower incomes and particularly poorer whites. And part of that, you know, you look at the reflection of his agenda. He was talking about an anti-poverty agenda, reducing inequality, rebuilding American unions, dealing with things like universal health care, universal education at the higher ed level, tax hikes on the rich to pay for these things. Well, he got a lot of support from younger Americans who were financially insecure and from financially insecure people in general, particularly financially insecure whites. This campaign really failed on a tremendous level in terms of appealing to poorer people of color who really didn't come down on the side of supporting this campaign at all. A lot of them went toward the Clinton campaign because there was at least some sort of rhetoric there talking about the importance of some of these identity-based movements. I think what we're going to need in the future is a way to speak to different levels of repression. This idea of class-based, race-based, gender-based. Regardless of whether you're a Marxist or a socialist or a liberal or whatever, and regardless of whether you think that economics is tantamount and the most important factor in society, I agree with that personally. You know, that in a capitalistic society, the big divide today is increasingly economic in terms of inequality, even as we make progress on fighting racism and sexism. Even if that's the case, a successful political party that's going to unite disadvantaged groups of Americans is going to be a party that places a strong emphasis on all three of these things, in addition to other elements or dimensions of repression. It has to happen, and if these things aren't sort of brought to the front, you're just not going to have that progressive party. So I think that's really sort of an important point here. I think one really interesting point when we talk about the anti-Trump protests is that there was sort of this initial success in bringing together lots of different groups of Americans along the lines of lots of different concerns because Donald Trump was so good at offending so many different types of people. He was an equal opportunity offender. He really didn't pull any punches for different groups of Americans. So you had the economic insecurity angle that came together with people protesting the attempted repeal of the Affordable Care Act. And whatever you want to say about the ACA, there were a lot of people who were poor who were going to be hurt by the repeal of Medicaid expansion and some of those subsidies that were going to people buying insurance. You have a racial angle that came together in these anti-Trump protests with Black Lives Matter protesters and that contingent clearly being visible. If you were at these protests, whether in D.C. or in other cities, you could see it. You have the sexism angle with the rise of Me Too, clearly having to do with the rise of Donald Trump and misogyny. You have the xenophobia angle and the protests of his very xenophobic foreign policies regarding immigration. I think the problem that we've run into with the anti-Trump protest is that the reality of the situation, as I argue in my book, is that it's not a progressive movement. It's a reactive movement. You could say reactionary, but I don't want to say that it's a right wing. When you use a term like reactionary, people think like Donald Trump style reactionary. It's not that. It's reactive. That's simultaneously the biggest source of its strength and weakness. Yes, it brings a lot of people together. That's the strength that so many people have protested this president. But at the same time, fine, you've got all these people together. Where do you go from there? Finding sort of a unifying vision is really the challenge. And we're definitely not at that point right now. There really is no sort of clear, defined progressive coalition that's come together into a political party to make this change. toward progressive reform in America, or even some sort of revolutionary change. So strengths and weaknesses, having those things sort of taken into account, we do need to sort of figure this out. Where all of these progressive-minded people with these different causes, where this is going, how we're going to actually build that. And I think that's partly where this 2018 election comes into the fray here. If you take a look at what was motivating people who came together in this election, you can clearly see a sense of economic anxiety that was driving people when they were asked in the exit polls what was motivating them and what was their concern in terms of voting out Republicans and voting in various Democrats. This was not, generally speaking, about economic anxiety. Most of the people who voted said they thought the economy was in good shape and doing well. Now, we can take issue with that. We can say, well, okay, so maybe unemployment is low, and I would take issue with it. Unemployment might be low, but inequality is higher than it's ever been in a century. And we don't seem to be in any danger of having an overabundance of sort of middle-class sustaining jobs in the United States with the rise of outsourcing and with the neoliberal sort of political turn. So I'm not going to be one of these people who sort of joins the choir and says, oh yeah, things are doing really well economically. I don't think that's the case at all. I'm just pointing out what people said in these surveys. So 68% of Americans who came out and voted said they thought the economy was doing good or excellent. Only about 30% said poor or not so good. What was motivating some of these voters, and this is a different way of measuring economic insecurity, it's sort of a subset measurement, you could say. The healthcare angle was a really big one. That's single-handedly, if you look at issues that were motivating people to come out and vote when they were asked, what was the most important issue for them? Healthcare was the big one. So there was this very real anxiety on the part of people who were worried about not only the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, but maybe this idea that government needs to be doing a better job of providing for healthcare in America. This was really like 41% of American voters said that that was motivating them. Immigration was about 23% of voters. The economy in general, about 22%. So healthcare was really sort of the big one here. Also, just generally speaking, people not liking Donald Trump. If you looked at the actual voters who turned out, by about a 10 percentage point margin, they cut strongly against Trump rather than in favor. So clearly those were the people who turned out, and that's really quite striking in a midterm election. Considering most of the time, midterm elections tend to be dominated by white people, middle sort of income white people, maybe middle income white Republicans. These are the traditional profiles that oftentimes you see in midterm elections, except when people are really pissed. We were talking about 2006 and the Iraq War, where it swung in the other direction against Republicans in that midterm, or in this case, in 2018. If you take a close look at the change from 2016 to 2018, and this is really quite interesting, in terms of various subgroups of Americans who are more likely to come out and vote. And so in this case, we're talking about the margin of support from different demographic groups in America that cut in favor of Democrats versus Republicans. Here's what happened. And we know this from looking specifically at these exit polls. The New York Times did a decent analysis of this. Black men, Hispanic men and women, white men and women. There was a significant shift among all of these groups in terms of becoming more likely to vote Democratic than Republican from 2016 to 2018. So there was a qualitative shift within these groups toward a movement against the Republican Party, we could say. Well, what's the alternative and how good is it? That's another point entirely. But clearly, if this is a judgment on the status quo and the people who are in power, you have a lot of people within those groups who are very angry. Younger Americans, too. There was definitely a qualitative shift away from the Republican Party and toward Democrats from 2016 to 2018. That's been documented. Men and women, both. Both of those groups, just looking at gender. Looking at white people in general, there was a shift away from the Republican Party. Also with income, particularly people who made less than $30,000 a year, that group, and people making $50,000 to $100,000 a year. So not so much the 30 to 50,000 crowd or over 100,000 crowd, but those other two groups. So you could say maybe middle income earners and lower income earners. Among those two groups, there was definitely a noticeable qualitative shift against and in opposition to the Republican Party. Why does all of this matter? It matters because we have to have, an honest and frank discussion as Americans about what we want in the future and where all of this anger, and I guess you could say populism, because I've been using that term, where it should be directed and where we want it to go. Because there is a fight going on within the Democratic Party about what their identity is going to be, and there are a lot of people on the left who would like to see another different party entirely. Maybe a labor-based party, a third party of some kind. So my job, I would say, as an intellectual, as an academic, as an activist, is not to be a shill for any particular party, particularly not the Democratic Party, because I don't think that they have done anywhere near enough to earn me going out and canvassing for them. I'll just be perfectly honest about that. There were some people who are liberal and left that I know in academia who did go out and do that. That's not something that I'm interested in selling here to you today. I've always sort of seen myself as nonpartisan in terms of my analysis. But we have to figure out one way or another how this change is going to happen. One possibility is that the Democratic Party does have some kind of real serious qualitative shift towards progressive politics. That may happen in the future depending on this sort of schism we have right now between the Sanderist sort of liberals versus the neoliberal Democrats. If we don't want that route, if we want a real sort of labor-based party or third party, the way to achieve that, and the historian Paul Street, who writes for Counterpunch and other progressive venues, he made this point recently in his piece he wrote for Counterpunch about lesser evil voting or strategic voting. He said, if you want a real third party, then we have to have some sort of national convention to totally rewrite how election laws are written. Because until that happens, you're wasting your time. People can say all day long, you should vote for the third party candidate. There's a reason why these people have become professional losers in the United States. By being professional losers, I mean you can look race after race after race in the House and Senate, and virtually every time, with 99.5% of the time, they lose. That's professional losing. This system has to be changed if you want to have a real third party. And until that happens, forget it. Forget about this idea that you as an individual are going to advocate for people to just spontaneously turn out and vote third party, because it's just not going to happen. You need to have a convention where people, there is a constitutional change that bans money in politics for these two major parties, which have infinite amounts of money in bottomless pockets to buy up all the exposure in the ads. You need to have debates for presidential elections that actually have third-party candidates who are invited, and that's guaranteed to them. Because otherwise, if you have the two major parties doing this, these candidates just aren't going to get any exposure, not any serious exposure. If they're not in the debates, you have to have some sort of public mechanism through which corporate media are required as part of their broadcasting licenses to give equal time to these candidates, whether it's third-party or major party. And until that happens, these people are not going to get exposure if they don't have the money to buy the ads. You need to have ballot access laws that are rewritten state after state after state, granting automatic access to third-party candidates in addition to major party candidates. We need, ideally, I would say, we need to have some sort of public proportional representation system where third parties can actually get some percent of the vote when it comes to voting for members of Congress. And that percentage of the vote can actually translate into a percentage of seats, rather than having a winner-take-all system where you get everything in terms of a majority of votes or a plurality, or you don't, and you either get all of the representation with single-member districts or you get nothing. So I'm not against the third-party approach. I think it's a great approach, but we should really stop kidding ourselves. And unless those changes happen, it's just not a viable option. So I think there needs to be this discussion. I'm not interested in answering one way or another definitively which one of those two things needs to happen. I think that progressives need to talk about this and we need to work through it, whether it be a major sort of party coup or insurgency or whether it be a third party one. Either way, you know, there have to be sort of major changes. One way or another, it has to happen. There needs to be a progressive party, and that party needs to explicitly focus on the needs and interests of all different types of groups of disadvantaged Americans across race, class, gender lines, sexual identity, environmental concerns. All of these things need to be brought together because it's the only way you're going to get any sort of critical mass to build that progressive party. It's really easy on the left today. I've noticed with a lot of people, I get people writing to me, commenting, Facebook, social media, through email, being against things, right? We can complain all day long, what's wrong with the Democratic Party? What's wrong with the electoral system? What's wrong with the American economy? But at some point, we need to build something positive. So I think that these discussions need to happen. I'm going to leave it there because I think I've sort of summarized the three main points I wanted to get through between populism, social movements, and this election. I think these are very exciting times as an American in terms of the potential for some sort of change, but it has to be mobilized in a productive, sort of positive way where people are brought together into a large coalition. I don't think we get to that point by people constantly railing on different types of left movements as promoting identity politics. Everything's an identity, whether it's class, race, gender, sexual orientation, or whatever. The key is bringing together disadvantaged groups across these identities and building a real progressive coalition. And we haven't done a very good job of that as progressives or leftists to this point. We need to do a better job. Thank you. So the question being how we would sort of flesh out the idea of a convention. Well, I think it's pretty clear that it's not just going to happen based on the volition of the people who hold political power because they've created this whole intricate system based on political rules and funding of elections that works against the idea of institutional challenges. I think the only real hope for this is maybe one of two venues. Maybe one, you know, at some point people sort of recognize that this is a good thing and that there's enough momentum moving from 2018 into 2020 onward with people just being angry enough with the status quo that we start getting community groups together and joining across the nation to push for this convention and force these major political leaders to do it. Now, that sounds very idealistic. I'm not sure how likely it is to happen that groups are just going to sort of figure this out and push forward. I think maybe more likely. This has to do with my sort of Marxian background here. You know, Marx famously said, men make their own history, but not under circumstances of their own choosing. If economic insecurity and insecurity in general is driving these movements, and this is going to make me really unpopular to say this, but maybe it's just true. Maybe we need more of that. We need more insecurity, instability. When we're talking about rising inequality, rising poverty, another economic crash, maybe that's what it's going to take for people to get off their asses and form these organizations within their communities and pressure their political leaders, and that kind of instability. Now, I'm not talking necessarily about something close to revolutionary politics, because I really don't think Americans are anywhere near a revolutionary class consciousness at this point. But just a generalized anger that could produce serious reform. You know, those things can happen very quickly during times of tremendous instability. A lot of pressure and critical mass gets developed very quickly and things become possible that people didn't think were possible before. So unfortunately, I think that's one of the big lessons that comes out of this research, that insecurity makes people desperate and angry, and then that's sort of the mother of invention. We'll see what happens, but I think that that's probably going to be a big part of this. So I think there are three points there worth briefly commenting on. One is the idea of elections and how legitimate those really are for producing change. I think I'm sort of in the same ballpark that you are, Camp, in the sense that I would say that, you know, elections and voting is something you do for 5 minutes on a day, right? I don't think that that's the primary venue through which progressive change happens. I think that's sort of an afterthought, that when you have a critical mass of people whose values have been transformed by activism and social movements, then maybe there's some sort of impetus for elections to maybe reflect some sort of policy changes, at least in the sense that at some point there have to be changes, right, institutionally. And at some point people have to be elected to do that. But generally speaking, you know, there's a reason why I said I don't spend my time canvassing for Democrats, because that's not my primary interest. My primary interest has been in the last couple of years being part of community organizations who are pushing for progressive changes and doing outreach within communities and protest and organizing. So I think that's really where we should be focusing our time primarily. And if we're doing those things properly, these other things should eventually sort of come around and fall into place. So this idea of extra institutional venues like protest and social movements versus institutional ones, that's really the point of the whole book, that these extra institutional venues like protest and movements are the primary way in which change is going to happen, not the elections. So we spend an awful lot of time arguing about elections, not a lot of time doing things. We've got professional leftists who are great pontificators and intellectuals, but then you got to get off your ass too. That's the problem.
Which book?
It's called Rebellion in America, so it'll be out within the next year. And anyone who is interested in it, I can send you a PDF. You can see it well before a year from now. You can see it tomorrow if you want. The final point, you brought up about right-wing populism. What's the end game? What do they want? Well, there's a reason why I brought up the whole point about creeping fascism. I mean, I think you're talking about half of the Republican Party today actively saying, shut down 2020 if Trump says it's necessary to combat voter fraud. And the media are the enemy of the people. Shut them down. There's an interesting poll that recently just came out, and they said half of Republicans said it's fake news if it's accurate news, but also critical of Trump. So now truth is the enemy. Accurate news that criticizes Trump is fake. So this is sort of Orwellian propaganda, up is down, black is white kind of fictions and manipulation. That is a hallmark of fascistic policies and authoritarian cult of personality politics. Reaching back to, you know, you can talk about Mussolini-style fascism. I mean, there's very much at the forefront of this fascistic program, the idea that you look to the leader and the leader determines reality and what it is, and they interpret it for everyone else, the masses. So, I mean, obviously it's a legitimate concern. I mean, we're dangerously reaching into that territory when you have this level of a population willing to embrace those kinds of authoritarian beliefs. So I think that that's a good point. So the first point about John Sides, the book Identity Crisis, one nice thing is that there's this lingering commitment among academics to evidence. So, you know, call us crazy, but there are a number of books that are coming out now, it will include mine, but many others, that are actually looking at this data and showing, basically the Sides book, from what I remember looking at it, I haven't finished it, but I'm in the middle of it, that if you look at like 2012 to 2016, there really wasn't any evidence that there was some sort of growing economic frustration that was informing Republican voting, that it was these other identity-based issues having to do with race and immigration and so on. I mean, you just find study after study after study that I've been seeing recently, they're all pointing in that same exact direction. So it's something that is becoming finally more prevalent in the academic community because people care about data and evidence. It has not really shifted enough in terms of journalistic discussion. Hopefully at some point there will be that shift if there are enough intellectuals who are active publicly in these kinds of settings. We'll have to see what happens. I think you made a good point about the rise of Trump and in the primary. I think that I probably misspoke a little bit. You know, when I said politics as usual, I meant just the idea that being a Republican was the best predictor of supporting Trump. So, but what does it mean to be a Republican? I think that's a good point that you brought up, that there really has been this big shift. His rhetoric, the free trade stuff, right? That was a predictor of increased support for Trump, the critical of free trade rhetoric. Interestingly enough, the Gallup Corporation did a survey of this, and they found out that the people who were more likely to buy into this, to be Trump supporters and concerned with free trade, said that they had been negatively impacted by free trade, but there was actually no evidence that they had been, that they weren't more likely to come from areas of the country that were economically depressed. Now, I think it's sort of a double-edged sword there. On the one hand, it's good that you had people who are recognizing that free trade has had a negative impact on people. On the other hand, if it just takes a cult of personality to get you there, I don't know that there is a strong impetus for how we're going to actually deal with it, especially when that cult of personality person, in this case, doesn't do anything to actually address it. I mean, maybe he has a trade war with China or something, but where are these manufacturing jobs that were supposed to come back? And so that we haven't seen that. So there was that going on sort of in the primary. It, as you said, I think correctly, really hasn't sort of materialized in any sort of actual qualitative change in terms of how he's actually governed. But it's interesting, you know, you had that sort of brief window where people were finally becoming open to this idea, and, you know, could you sort of cultivate that? I don't know. It would be great to see if you could cultivate some sort of left-right push against free trade, but if it's purely contingent upon the cult of a personality and it rises and falls with that, I'm not optimistic. So I don't know, I guess we'll have to sort of see what happens and if that can be mobilized again. Immigration being, yeah, you do see some actual policy changes. In terms of the DSA stuff, I think it's really interesting. I think it's fascinating. And it's something that has to do with sort of, I guess you would say, a second tier impact, going back to some of these progressive social movements from earlier on. First, you have the rise of Sanders. And now where does that lead to? So you have that's sort of the first impact of these progressive movements. Where does that go in the future? There are some real possibilities there if we're talking about short to midterm sort of institutional reform, if we're talking about within the actual Democratic Party. I think if there is going to be reform, this is the way that it's going to have to go. I would say that it's something that I'm interested in researching in the future. It's something that hasn't got as much media and intellectual discussion as it needs or polling attention. So it's hard for me to speak really authoritatively about it until I can sort of dig into it more. I think it's the kind of thing with the rise of this segment of the Democratic Party that's probably something that, you know, as progressives we need to be open to and actually explore moving forward. I think it's the next sort of part of this process I'm talking about of the rise of sort of progressive pressure for change. So I guess I would say that that's a good challenge to me and to other people that, you know, we need to look into this more and to understand it better because it's unplaying and unfolding as we speak. So thank you for that. This is a great point. So, you know, 70%, I think, of people who make less than $10,000 a year in their household say they're not lower class. So this idea of making people think that they're not middle class, you have an issue in America where people at the bottom end of the economic spectrum radically overestimate their status and people at the top radically underestimate it. It's like a majority of millionaires say they're middle class. People know this? Majority of millionaires say they're not upper class. Nobody. The richest country in the history of humanity and the most inequality.
Inhumanity.
Yeah, in humanity. Nobody's upper class and nobody's lower class.
George W. Bush said he was upper middle class.
Everybody's middle class. 90% of Americans say they're middle class. Like 1% say they're upper class. I think that my research helps to try and add some sort of sobering element to this discussion of economic insecurity. And if we're talking about people making less than $30,000 a year, I mean, the lesson here is that these people have, I think, correctly interpreted what their interests are financially and economically and what they want, rather than this very sort of contemptuous narrative that for a long time had defined academia and journalism where, well, maybe, you know, these unfortunate and less advantaged, disadvantaged groups are, you know, maybe they're racist and xenophobic and misogynistic, but it's okay because they don't know any better because they're economically angry. And that whole narrative I really tried to demolish here. I mean, you're talking about people who are relatively privileged in terms of a white demographic, white male, white Republican, more middle to upper class, middle to upper income, as driving a lot of that prejudice. So, you know, there have been academics like, I guess one of the best examples would be Arlie Hochschild. She wrote the book Strangers Among Us, where it's like the Berkeley liberal professor goes and slums it with Southwestern Louisiana Tea Partiers who are down on their luck, and damn it if they're all just ignorant, but, you know, they're very sincere, and I made friends with these people, and we have to understand their frustrations. And that whole narrative was very anecdotal. It turns out, if you look at the actual survey data, not accurate either. I mean, yeah, if you go to a rural part of a red state that's deeply conservative, you can find people who are poor and Republican. But that's not necessarily reflective of, across an entire nation, what's going on with people making less than $30,000 a year, as you mentioned. So, yeah, I think these are all important points that I'm trying to hit on here and add some more sanity to the discussion, at least.
Whatever else they produce from the universities in the interest of business these days. So thank you.
Thanks. So there are three points here. I'll try to briefly go through each one of these things. I think the first point about, you know, we can have reform without a constitutional convention with the FCC, particularly reforming access to the airwaves. I think that's true, but I would also add that the problem that you run into in terms of public access to the airwaves is you still have the issue of infinite money in elections. So I think that's where the Constitutional Convention needs to come in. And these things should all be rolled into a convention if you're going to be talking about them anyways. Unless you find a way to repeal and overturn the Supreme Court's money equals free speech formula, you're always going to have this radical inequality within these elections in terms of exposure. So I think there are, you know, those kind of things that the FCC, for example, could be doing in the short term, but without the sort of comprehensive change in the fundamental challenge to the way that the right-wingers on the court are looking at these issues, we're not going to get to where we need to be. In terms of the Trump anger, I think it's very clear that there's a lot of anger with this idea of the political establishment, which is corrupt, and that this was motivating voting. I think the problem that comes in is that it's so entirely one-sided. The idea is, yes, they're corrupt, yes, they're bad, and yes, they hurt us, and it's all those damn Democrats. So just go and vote Republican and everything will be taken care of. If that's the interpretation, which it has been, then we're going to be worse off. Because you've got the death of a thousand cuts with the Democratic Party in terms of the policies they have pursued that hurt people. And then you've got the Bruce Rauner hatchet to the skull approach, which is 10 times more extreme. They're both terrible, but you know, if that's your solution, good luck. So you know, we need to get beyond that sort of extremely limited parochial thinking in terms of, you know, oh, it's just the Democrats, okay. Well, I'm not going to get very far with that. The enemy of the people language I've been very careful myself to avoid using, although I totally hear what you're saying and agree that, you know, fake news. I wrote a whole piece about this. Fake news predates the last 2 years. I wrote for Counterpunch within the last year or so. I wrote that. Going back to the Iraq War and other examples of manipulation and propaganda, I think we need to be very careful, though, in terms of the language we use, because the reason why I won't use the term enemy of the people is because that is the Trump term, and to be perfectly clear about it, he comes to bury the press, not to save it. I come, and other progressives come, with this idea that we should have a vibrant, public-funded, taxpayer-funded, nonprofit media system to challenge corporatist values, and that you can't have that without the First Amendment. So when he pisses all over the First Amendment, or tries to, you know, again, he's come to bury these things, not to save them. So, you know, I think there's a space in there where we can be critical of corporate media and distortion, but without using the kind of language that Trump has used, because people can get false impressions very easily of what you're saying. Well, one thing I should have brought up with regard to that point is that, you know, I think a lot of people were caught by surprise by this idea of creeping fascism in America. The problem is that, particularly among a lot of intellectuals, they've really just been fundamentally intellectually asleep at the wheel on this issue, because this stuff's been going on for decades. If you were, you know, spend any time in the 90s or 2000s or 2010s, I used to, for example, work at a community college in central Illinois, and I would drive to the satellite campus a few times a week to teach a class, and there'd be nothing on the radio outside of AM, sports radio, or Rush Limbaugh. And, you know, you could hear this creeping sort of authoritarian politics and this cult of personality, in his case, and other right-wing media pundits. And this kind of cultivation of crazy, this kind of Frankenstein monster creeping fascism doesn't just come out of nowhere. This has been long-standing. You've had a lot of intellectuals for a very long time, whether it's in the mainstream media or among academics, who have just completely avoided being critical of that trend, this right-wing sort of echo chamber. Because, you know, these kinds of beliefs manifest themselves within that echo chamber and within that insulated setting where people start to think that these things are common sense because it's all they're hearing. At some point, if I want to alienate my few remaining friends in higher ed, I'll write that book about the complete failure of higher ed in terms of promoting critical thought. Maybe, who knows, maybe at some point I'll get around to it. It's a good point, though. You know, I mean, it's clearly happening that you can't have the rise of a figure like Donald Trump and the rise of creeping fascism without that contempt for critical thought and evidence-based reasoning, and that happens in a vacuum when educational institutions fail to impress upon people's scientific thinking. Well, 40% of Americans are going through the higher ed system, and climate change is as low as a priority as it's been. Clearly, there's a disconnect, right, between reality and the rising crisis versus how much they've pushed it, which they have not done the job. Academics in general, including myself and others, you know, we need to do a much better job. It just hasn't happened. A lot of really important points there. I would say, trying to sort of split those up a little bit, one interesting thing I found in my research, which I didn't have time to talk about here, is while, you know, it is true, you do have a significant number of people who are white, sort of working class, and maybe also economically insecure, who did vote for Trump, and maybe some of that fell into the free trade rhetoric and that appeal as well. So my research is really just trying to sort of add more nuance to these discussions and have actual data, because the way that they get discussed in the media is that these sort of all-encompassing narratives get created. But so certainly there's room, though, for what you're saying in terms of that there are people who are economically insecure who vote Republican, right? It may not be the majority, but they do exist, right? And one thing in particular in my book that I thought was really interesting was that more so than economic frustration in terms of financial insecurity, there was this idea of the overworked American, and that really was statistically tied to voting for Trump. And it was tied to Trump in a way where it wasn't just people who were working a second job or overtime, but people who were working overtime and with a second job who also were falling into all types of xenophobic views. So there was this idea that the quality of living is slipping, and also we have these immigrants to blame who are coming and taking American jobs and they're threatening me. So there was this weird sort of fusion between occupational anxiety and xenophobia. So I feel like in the book, I didn't get to do justice to it here. I'm trying to sort of do justice to some of that stuff. I think I see from the statistics that like 1 in 10 Sanders voters went for Trump. So there's definitely some of that cross-pollination going on too. And that would suggest that there are opportunities for, you know, trying to peel off people who might be frustrated and have voted for Trump, who might be able to cultivate them. I think the challenge is getting past the xenophobic, racist, misogynistic stuff, and combating that and finding a way to address the legitimate economic grievance that's there. In terms of the global right-wing populism, that's something that this book didn't spend a lot of time on. I think it sort of cuts both ways. In one sense, there's this recognition along with these political leaders that they have a common interest. On the other hand, Trump's populism is premised explicitly on sort of rabid xenophobic hatred of foreign peoples. I think that's important in the sense that it manifests itself in just a complete disinterest in the world. We're America, USA, USA. We don't need to care about other people. And that's been a problem for decades now.
America first.
Yeah. So it's something worth talking about, but it does seem to cut in different directions in terms of how it actually plays out in real life. You know, maybe these political leaders think that there's some value of sort of drawing on each other, but the populism of Trump also is explicitly premised upon getting people not to care about what's happening in the world around them. Just this fortress America sort of mentality. So we could say cosmopolitan right-wing white nationalism.
Something like that.
Interesting.
They're not all white, though. I mean, yeah.
Not all of them, right. Needs to be researched more and understood better. I've tried to be as agnostic as I could in terms of saying that people should definitely support, you know, democratic insurgents versus third party. I guess that's part of me where I'm trying to be as inclusive as I can for different progressives and also recognize that I don't have the crystal ball, so I'm inclined to be very sympathetic to what you're saying, but I also recognize that I don't have that crystal ball, so who knows for sure. But I think it's a healthy skepticism to say that, you know, unless you deal with the money issue, that it's sort of predetermined. If you can buy outcomes, which is why I was talking about this idea of some sort of convention, you know, maybe there is not a institutional mechanism for changing all of this. It's very possible. And you have to talk about societal collapse, revolutionary change. That's certainly very possible. Maybe there are some situations in which electoral changes can be brought to bear on some kind of reform. I would say, to the extent that I'm in favor of the sort of electoral reform democratic approach, has changed somewhat recently with this UN report talking about 10 years. 10 years we have before it's too late, for without taking massive, you know, if we don't take massive change or efforts to change. So I don't see a third party or revolution coming. I don't see that coming in the next 5 to 10 years. So if we don't have, at least at the very least on that issue, some sort of institutional effort to change, and the only way that's going to happen is getting rid of Donald Trump and having some sort of democratic alternative. That to me seems like something that at the very least means we have to take the institutional route somewhat seriously. I mean, if we don't, it has to be done institutionally, and there's only one party at this point that has the wherewithal to even try to do that. So if that makes me somewhat of an institutionalist in the short term, then I'm also guilty of that. When I see 10 years, something has to be happened and someone has to do it. So, you know, long-term building, mid-term building, short-term, that's a short-term thing. 10 years.